And I'm going to talk to you about some of the work that I've been involved in for the last couple of years, since I started work at the World Council of Churches. But I inherited a large portfolio of long-standing work by the WCC, by colleagues in the past, who have led the work of engagement with North Korea and in putting dialogue and in encounter between North and South Koreans for more than 30 years now. So this is a long-standing commitment of the ecumenical movement of the WCC. It's not something that has emerged out of the latest round of tensions and so forth. It's not something that has been parachuted in, but is really a long-term commitment of this organization. So when I speak to you, I'm presenting some of my own work, but actually it's the basis that was built since the mid-1980s for where we are right now. Now, you'll remember that I think it was in May 2016, in the election campaign period, Donald Trump was asked about his stance with regard to North Korea. And he's reported to have said, "Why not? What's wrong with talking?" He said he wanted to talk Kim out of his damned nukes, even if the chances of success were minimal. He said he would even receive the North Korean leader in Washington. "I won't host a state dinner for him. Same goes for the Chinese and others who rip us off." Instead, he quipped, he would host the communist leaders at the conference table, serving them hamburgers. His statements were met with harsh criticism in the US, understandably, but in Pyongyang, the Republican politician received praise. North Korea's state media hailed Trump as a, quote, "wise politician," unquote. Now, compare that sort of exchange with the exchange we're seeing now between the United States and North Korea. And I have to say that I find the former preferable. I would rather have a bit of burger diplomacy going on than the alternative which we see right now, which is a very dangerous game. I'm going to tell you something now about the counterparts that the World Council of Churches works with and through in this regard. Starting with our counterparts in North Korea, the Korean Christians Federation. Now, still today, we are often confronted with the sort of quizzical expression whenever we refer to the Korean Christians Federation in North Korea. Are there really Christians in North Korea? Isn't religion illegal? Aren't Christians persecuted? Yes and no, mostly no. The Korean Christians Federation was founded in 1946 under the leadership of Kim Il-sung's mother's cousin. Kim Il-sung's own mother and his father, to a lesser extent, were Christians, and his mother particularly devout. And the leadership of this organization, the Korean Christians Federation, has always been held in his mother's family, the Kang family. It's currently led by Reverend Kang Myung-chol as chairperson, and you see him in the top right-hand corner, and by Reverend Ri Jong-ro as deputy chairperson. Some of you might remember that, I think it was 3 years ago, in 2014, we had a visit from both of these leaders from North Korea to the World Council of Churches, and they came to this church. Do you remember that? Who of you were present to see that? And I had many people come up to me afterwards and just astonished that it was even possible to have North Koreans here. The KCF is one of four officially recognized religious bodies in the DPRK. There are three others. The Korean Catholics Association, they treat Catholics as an entirely different religion. The Korean Buddhists Association and the Korean Chonduist Association. Now, I don't know much about Chonduism, but maybe some of our Korean colleagues could illuminate us on that later. All of these exist under the auspices of the Korean Workers' Party, which is one of the main instruments, the main entities in the political system of North Korea. The Korean Christians Federation actually has two physical church buildings, both of them in Pyongyang. One, the Bongsu Church, and you see the facade of it there, and the Chilgol Church. The Bongsu Church was built more recently, I think in the 80s. The Chilgol Church was reconstructed on the site of a former church in Pyongyang that was flattened. Everything in Pyongyang was flattened during the Korean War. But it was rebuilt on the site of a church where Kim Il-sung's mother used to worship. Otherwise, the KCF gets together in house church contexts. I have more images. If we have time later on, I'll show you a whole slideshow of images of these different structures. It operates a theological seminary right adjacent to the Bong Soo Church, and it runs a number of small-scale but significant social service activities, including a small bakery producing nutritionally enhanced bread products for kindergartens and orphanages. So you see, when you hear all that, it actually looks, sounds, smells like church. It looks like church. And although I'm not theologically trained, colleagues of mine who are and who have joined with us in worship services in Pyongyang say, this is not just propaganda. Yes, propaganda in it, but it's also got theological depth. So they are, in our view, a genuine community of worshiping, witnessing Christians. They only have about 12,000 members, though, so it's a small community. On the other side of the border, our counterpart, our main counterpart, is the National Council of Churches in Korea, in South Korea. It was founded in 1924 as the Chosun Christian Joint Council, has currently 15 member churches and organizations. It played a really prominent, a historic role, I think, in mobilizing during the time of the military dictatorships in South Korea, mobilizing for justice and for human rights. And it has, during, I don't know how long, but for a long time, organized a committee on peace and reunification, which works continuously for this relationship between North and South and for promoting dialogue and peace. Oops. Now, how did this all start? It began in the early to mid-80s by the World Council of Churches in response to messages that were informally being received about the need for the ecumenical movement to engage with North Korea and with the North Korean Christians. Now, part of the hidden backstory to the WCC's engagement is that before the beginning of the Korean War, WCC actually promoting the UN intervention, was promoting the sending of troops. And J. Foster Dulles, a member of our Commission on International Affairs at that time, actually drafted some of the language for the UN resolution that, in effect, launched the Korean War. So we have some negative history in this regard. And at a certain point, messages were being conveyed that WCC needed to engage for peace, not for war. And so some former colleagues of ours, Eric Weingartner from Canada, Victor Xu from Taiwan, and Park Kyung-seo from South Korea were among those who, on behalf of WCC, began to open up this channel of dialogue. And the launching point, the official launching point for it, was in 1984 in the Tozatsu consultation in Japan, where the ecumenical movement gathered in response to this message or this call to engage for peace. Unfortunately, North Korean counterparts couldn't attend at that point, but it was done and in close communication with the colleagues in the Korean Christians Federation. And South and North Korean Christians to this day mark their mutual recognition to that consultation in 1984. It was followed with a whole series of events and meetings and encounters and so forth, and you see some of them listed there. I won't go into all of it, but you can see that the WCC took its first visit to the DPRK in 1985, and that was the first time there was a direct official encounter with the Korean Christians Federation. There were meetings here in Switzerland, in Glion, where North Korean Christians did come, first time in 1986, and various delegations, more meetings. A major declaration issued by the National Council of Churches in South Korea in 1988 on the Declaration of the Churches of Korea on National Reunification and Peace. Now, I want you to pause for a second and just realize how important that was, because this was at a time when it was completely anathema to be talking about peace and dialogue with the North. Everything was about deconstructing the North and getting back to normal before the conflict. So to talk about churches' engagement for peace, peaceful coexistence in effect, was totally revolutionary at that time. And there were many occasions in which North Koreans actually from the KCF came and visited us in the wider world, including, look at this one, delegations from the NCC USA visited both parts of Korea in 1986 and 1987, and in 1989, a KCF delegation was hosted by the NCC USA, the first time since the war that a North Korean group, any North Korean group, had been granted visas to visit the USA. There's been a lot of diaconal engagement, humanitarian engagement with North Korea through the ecumenical channels over the year. Some of you will recall that there was a major famine in the early to mid-90s in North Korea, which was a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the loss of the normal supply channels that North Korea had existed on at that time, coupled with extreme weather events. So there was indeed a massive famine in North Korea. During that period of the famine response, the World Council of Churches, through its Asia desk, channeled some $43 million to North Korea for humanitarian relief. And that was done under the auspices of the Asia desk and our former colleague, Dr. Park Kyung-seo, who you see at the top right-hand corner there. He's had a very interesting career. After his service with the World Council of Churches, he went back to South Korea and was appointed as South Korea's first ambassador at large for human rights. And he served in that capacity from 2001 to 2007. He was an academic in between and thereafter. And now, as of August this year, he has been appointed as president of the South Korean Red Cross under the new government in South Korea. This is very significant because the first point of contact, official contact with North Korea in any renewal of a dialogue process will be, and has in the past, been through the Red Cross on humanitarian issues, including on family meetings, family reunifications. So Dr. Park is now back in an absolutely pivotal position in this current geopolitical context. It will be through him. It has been already through him that first official contact was made. We had news just a few days ago that he has had his first meeting with his North Korean counterparts to renew this relationship. You see Eric Weingartner down there on the bottom picture in between two North Korean counterparts. On the right is Reverend Ri Jong-ro, the still serving as deputy chairperson of the KCF. And Eric, both Eric and Kyung-seo continue to serve as senior advisors to us in our ongoing work with regard to promoting peace and dialogue on the Korean Peninsula. Following this experience of diaconal engagement with North Korea, we established, under the auspices of the WCC, the Christian Conference of Asia, and other counterparts, an ecumenical forum for peace, reunification, and development cooperation on the Korean Peninsula. So a number of churches around the world, churches and church-related organizations, who either have had or still have that sort of relationship with North Korea, the provision of humanitarian goods and services or development work, gather together in that forum, which is moderated by the World Council of Churches. The 10th Assembly of the WCC in Busan was obviously a major relaunching point. We met in South Korea. It was inevitable that we would be looking closely at the history of ecumenical relationships with North Korea and with the search for peace and reunification of the peninsula. So we had a major new policy statement from the Assembly, our highest body, to reinvigorate this commitment and to renew it for a new period. Tensions are, again, as we have seen, sadly, in the subsequent period, very much on the rise again. And there have been many things that have been done in the implementation of that desire for renewal and reinvigoration since the Assembly. And I have a list of some of the events that have taken place and initiatives taken. The BOSSE conference in June 2014 was the first time that we had met in that sort of ecumenical format with our North Korean counterparts for some years. I don't remember, there'd been a pause in the relationship, but that was a significant event in renewing this relationship. And that is the moment when our North Korean counterparts came here and also participated in worship in this church. In the context of that process, by the way, I have personally visited North Korea now on three occasions. We've had our North Korean counterparts come to us on numerous occasions in different parts of the world, most recently in Leipzig in the margins of the World Communion of Reformed Churches General Council meeting. And we've had a number of very significant... I should go back to that slide. A number of very significant discussions, including, I want to point out this one, International Ecumenical Conference on a Peace Treaty for the Korean Peninsula in November 2016. We held that in Hong Kong. Our North Korean counterparts came, our South Korean counterparts came, and we had a number of international representatives from churches all around the world to talk about this issue of the fact that there can be no peace anyway on the Korean Peninsula so long as the current political situation obtains, because it's still in a state of war. The Korean War has never ended. It has only been temporarily paused. There was an armistice agreement in 1953, a ceasefire, and there has never been a peace treaty. Our thesis is that that situation cannot help but infect the current politics of the region, a suspended and unresolved state of war. So we have been advocating for a long time that that armistice agreement needs to be replaced with a peace treaty, and that we don't need to wait for all of the current issues to be resolved. We simply need to draw a line under that history, that painful history of the Korean War, in order to be able to engage more realistically with the current threats and realities, which are very serious, but are very different now. So that's been something we've been pushing for a long time, and this conference was a major opportunity to do that. There's been another major policy position issued by the WCC in very recent days, in June this year, which reiterates some of the long-standing policy positions, but also sharpens them in the context of current developments in the region. So, and these are really key points, I would say, that confrontation by military or other means carries far higher risks of conflict with catastrophic consequences for all the people of the peninsula and of the region than prospects of leading to peace. And therefore, a paradigm shift is urgently needed in the current context. This stands to reason. Now, many people feel that the threats and the challenges that emanate, and the language, which is hyperbolic, that emanate from North Korea require a display of strength, that we need to be strong in order to confront this language. Maybe. But what if the risk is of falling off the brink of nuclear conflict? Is it still wise to try and project strength and to threaten back? Somebody has to be the adult in the room in this conversation. Somebody has to be responsible for de-escalation and for refusing to advance progress towards that unknowable brink of possibly catastrophic conflict. We don't know where the tipping point might be, but we know that we're getting closer to it. We want to encourage the new South Korean president, Mr. Moon Jae-in, in his stated commitment to dialogue with North Korea. We, in fact, met with President Moon only 3 weeks after he was elected, at the end of May, in order to do exactly that, to convey to him our support for the implementation of the commitments he'd made to opening up new dialogue initiatives with North Korea, to de-escalate, to bring things back from that brink of conflict. We appealed urgently to all states engaged in the perilously escalating military confrontation in the region to refrain from further escalation and to pursue instead initiatives to reduce tensions and create a window for new dialogue initiatives. We called for a freeze on both the annual joint US-South Korean military exercises and further missile or nuclear weapon tests by North Korea. I want to pause there and explain something. So very often in our own media, what we see is what gets onto our news is, oh my God, North Korea has launched another missile, or North Korea has done another nuclear test. And what we aren't told is the context from the North Korean perspective of why these things happen at that time. Now, many of us don't know that twice yearly, major joint military exercises are run regularly by the US and South Korea, massing troops and assets on the peninsula for joint military exercises. Now, we might think, well, that's fine, you know, naturally, we have to prepare ourselves for the possibility of war in that conflict. But think again, the geography of the Korean Peninsula, how small everything is, how close it is to the border, to Pyongyang. Now, if you have, as we did recently, 100,000 Russian troops massed on the border of the Baltic countries, okay, we're a bit alarmed by that, no? We're a bit alarmed. Russians say, it's just military exercises, nothing to worry about. Normal business in terms of our military preparedness. So now think about that, these joint US and South Korean exercises from the perspective of the North Koreans. Many troops, many assets, minutes away from the border. Of course it's provocative. And it's typically after such military exercises, North Koreans will make a display of strength. Don't mess with us, because look, we've got nuclear weapons. Not apologizing for it, just saying it's better if we understand the context in which these things emerge. And that brings us back to the issue of how do we de-escalate? How do we stop this cycle of provocation? And there is on the table in the political discussion from China a proposal for a freeze for a freeze, which is exactly this issue. Let's freeze those joint military exercises in exchange for North Korea freezing its testing program. We don't know if North Korea would accept that, but it seems to me that that's the most logical thing to do in the current context. No? And yet, nobody has been taking this very sensible, to my mind, proposal seriously. It is not gaining traction. I also want to, at this point, say, to be clear, WCC does not support or condone North Koreans' development of nuclear weapons. On the contrary, we want to see nuclear weapons be gotten rid of everywhere, not only on the Korean Peninsula, but everywhere. So we are celebrating, during these days, the Nobel Peace Prize to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which is something that the World Council of Churches has been working in and supporting for decades. And I'm very sorry that our colleague Jonathan Frerix isn't able to be here to celebrate that moment with us during these days. But that's the expression of our ambition. We want to see an end to these things everywhere. So we do not condone North Korea's development and possession of nuclear weapons, but what we have to do is recognize it as a reality. It's the genie is out of the bottle. In that case, there is no way at this point that North Korea is going to give up its nuclear weapons. I have heard myself from North Korean counterparts saying, look what happened to Gaddafi. Gaddafi was persuaded to give up his programs of weapons of mass destruction, and he was briefly celebrated. Then what happened the next day? We're not going to let that happen to our regime. Now, these couple of slides are just to illustrate how much communications outputs have come from the WCC on this issue over the last couple of years. It's been quite a lot. There are probably few other issues that have generated such amount of communications outputs from our side. And that's kind of a summary of the key messages that we have developed and are presenting. I apologize to my colleague Jin Yang, because he's seen most of this presentation just a couple of days ago when we made it for US church leaders to try and engage their support and their action in encouraging de-escalation, not further escalation of rhetoric. Something, by the way, in this context. It's not nothing. Even if it's just bluster, it carries the risk of pushing over that brink, and people have to take that very seriously. You can read that for yourself. But what I'd also like to do, if we have still a few more minutes, is to show you some pictures that have come from my own travels in North Korea, but also from pictures taken by Sean Hawkey. Some of you may know Sean Hawkey. He's a photojournalist that, of course, yes, you do, Christine. He's very much used in ecumenical circles for his photojournalism skills. So happened that not so long ago, he took a trip, a vacation, a holiday, in North Korea with his family and came back with some striking imagery, really, really striking imagery. And I'll show you some of those photos. But first, maybe I should pause for a second and just see if there's any questions or issues you'd like to explore already now. Who wants to raise Otto Warmbier's case? Yes, please. Okay, question.
Thank you. You already mentioned that you already engaged with the American church leaders. So can you give a little bit background to that, that how willing they are going to go to the political route and try to find a solution?
Well, watch this space. That only happened. How many days ago, Junyang? 2-3 days ago? Yeah. Look, my impression is that the U.S. church leaders are in the same position as almost all the rest of us, that we don't know enough about the situation. We accept the perspectives that come from our mainstream media, which are very black and white, you know, and so we don't really have the information or the understanding that enables us to engage practically with the issue. So most people, amongst the US church leaders included, would tend to accept the argument that we need to be strong against such a threatening and irrational, apparently, government or regime. And we're trying to present a more nuanced perspective and say, well, you know, we don't have to, and we don't like the regime, we don't like the policies, we don't like the political system or social system that obtains in North Korea, but that's not the point. The point is, how do we mitigate the now imminent and catastrophic threat of conflict? So I think we've helped to equip them a little bit better with information and perspectives and some of this history that hopefully will encourage them to be more active in that context. But watch this space. We'll see how that goes. What I can tell you is that the National Council of Churches in the USA, under the leadership of Jim Winkler, is very engaged. And in fact, it was from Jim Winkler that we were requested to help equip U.S. church leaders with what they need, some more nuance to enable them to take up this task. I think you had a question for Lewis.
Thank you so much, Peter. My question maybe is difficult to ask, but it has more to do with what has happened so far also touches on the issues at stake in the Korean Peninsula. I'm asking this because I'm interested in the involvement of women in this process. And since I see that the major approach has been top-bottom, because it has affected the leadership, it has involved leadership, I'm wondering whether there is a grassroots movement that also involves women into this process.
Yes and no. The World Council of Churches has repeatedly, from the very beginning, reiterated its commitment to engaging women and young people from both sides of the border in dialogue and in exchange and in mobilization. That has been possible sometimes, depending upon the political circumstances at the time. More recently, it hasn't been possible. In particular, it hasn't been possible to bring young people together, which would be my real strategic ambition. However, there have been moments where groups of women from both North and South have been able to be gathered in Canada, notably, through the work of Eric Weingartner. And we hope that that can be repeated and scaled up. I also want to point out that there has been a very interesting development from women's groups, including involving civil society women's groups, but also involving the World YWCA, or the Korean YWCA, in the so-called Women Cross the DMZ movement, where senior international women Nobel Peace Prize laureates and others from South Korea and WCC colleagues gathered together in order to make that demonstration of crossing this geopolitical and military divide. We're in very close touch with our counterparts in the Women Cross the DMZ movement, and we're even considering whether we can attach to that a Church Leaders Cross the DMZ activity. I'm conscious that this is primarily for publicity and for awareness raising, and maybe it doesn't change the political calculations, which we also have to be working on, but I think that's a very elegant expression of what we're trying to do, to actually physically cross this most highly militarized border in the world today. Please, Andre.
Thank you so much. Fascinating to hear about all of this. I have a question. Like, I see WCC's role, you know, putting key messages across, dialogue, etc. I'm just wondering, you know, you have people like Switzerland and Sweden and Nobel Peace laureates who act as kind of political intermediaries and sit there in neutral ways. And it sounds to me like the WCC is playing a little bit of a similar role. But I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the what does it mean to be a person of faith and a believer in Jesus in this context? And what does it mean being Christian and North Korea and South Korea? Thanks.
Well, ideally, as in perhaps every other political division, the idea is that our Christian commitment is something more fundamental that binds us together despite political confrontations. And I think that there is something of that in the relationship that we have with KCF, between KCF and NCCK and with other international church partners. I'm not sure, to be quite honest, whether that will prevail over the political commitments position in North Korea. But it's what we seek to work on. It's what we seek to mobilize for this purpose. And so far, it has worked in terms of keeping that channel of communication and encounter open. So at a certain point, and still even now, I would say, there was no other regular, officially sponsored channel of dialogue and encounter between North and South Koreans. There had been, but they were all progressively shut down during periods of increased tension. Mainly, not by the North Koreans, but by the South Korean government. So at a certain point, we found ourselves as the unique instrument for any sort of people-to-people encounter, regular people-to-people encounter between North and South Koreans. Sometimes I'm asked, you know, what is our plan, what is our ambition, what is our strategy for promoting peace and reunification? I mean, I don't know. But what we have in our hands is a channel for people-to-people encounter. And if there is one sure antidote for the enemy images that are being promulgated by other actors, it's people-to-people encounter. So when I'm asked that question, I say, my ambitions are simple. I just want to maintain and scale up that channel for people-to-people encounter. Now, if that relationship can also be an asset in political contexts, great. And we're in touch with many counterparts at governmental level, in particular with the Norwegian government, who's been trying to mediate between the parties, with the Swedish government, with the South Korean government, obviously, at the highest levels, and to some extent with the US authorities, although primarily through the State Department, which, as you've seen in recent days, is increasingly sidelined from the main decision-making processes here. By the way, I have to say that I have never heard a more terrifying statement than when the President of the United States instructs the Secretary of State to refrain from dialogue and that we will do what's necessary. I mean, that is terrifying. I think, Che, you had your hand up here, didn't you?
Yeah, well, maybe you anticipate. I don't know. I put my hand up. It must have seen it in my face. Thank you, Peter. That was a really interesting presentation. Like, you were talking about political calculations before. And I guess my question is, for an allegedly God-fearing president in a God-fearing country, to what extent do you feel those political calculations can be influenced by pressure from a church movement through WCC in the United States at the moment? Is that way too aspirational, or is there any hope at all, given that his campaign was built on a God-fearing part of the country?
Well, the fact of the matter is that most of our membership in the US mainline churches don't have the access to the Trump administration, even less than they had to the Obama administration, which, let me tell you, wasn't great either. But even less now. Those who do have access to the Trump administration from amongst the religious leaders tend to be the independent Pentecostal evangelical figures and only selected individuals amongst those. On the other hand, the concern is becoming more prominent the concern about this issue is becoming more prominent also amongst the evangelical and Pentecostal. And we have some of those who participated in our teleconference the other day are from that constituency. So we're hoping to build a bridge between, engage both mainline and evangelical Pentecostal groups in this common concern. Now, whether we can influence the administration like the Trump administration, I don't know, but we damn well better try.
I just want to add to your questions that you said why we, as Christians, should be engaged in this conflict or peace. Because we are called to become a peacemaker. And that's basic as bottom line. But as he said, WCC's engagement is only channel that we can talk with North Korea. Moon Jae-in trying to communicate, make dialogue with North Korea, but they never responded. But we are the only, maybe the rare only channel to make this dialogue happen. That's why we need to do it. We know the United States, Rex Tillerson, he said that he has several multiple channels to talk with North Korea, but it could be a temporary discussion, dialogue. But we are permanent, I will say, can I say? It's been more than 30 years dialogue. We will continue to do it.
Yeah, and that brings us back to the beginning of the slideshow. So thank you for your attention, and thank you very much for your interest. And let's hope that things move in a better direction, because this is probably the most serious risk that we currently face in global affairs right now in terms of risks of catastrophic conflict. And if we have such a catastrophic conflict, it will not just be a tragedy for the Korean people, but I think for everybody in the region and the world. So thank you very much.